23 years ago, two men dressed as police officers bound and gagged two guards at Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. They stole 13 works of art, today worth over $500 million. The true-to-life art heist is the subject of B.A. Shapiro's novel, The Art Forger. In fact, Barbara Shapiro is in town today and joins us in our studios right now. Welcome, Barbara.
Well, thank you.
You know, Boston figures prominently in this novel, and I believe you're a resident of that fair city.
I am, and I love it very much.
It comes across, actually, I think, in reading The Art Forger, which I'm not done with yet, so I can't spoil the ending.
Good.
Because it is a mystery. It is an interesting plot that moves us through different parts of both the art world and people who aren't always telling the truth. So I'm always liking a writer who has that sense of place, and it feels like Boston with the Back Bay and all. I get a sense of what that's like. Was that important to you to get across?
Yeah, it was important, and it was very easy because that's where I live.
And the art world, though, I don't think of Boston that much, and yet you're telling us here about a museum, the Isabella Stewart Museum. You're bringing in other parts of it. Sounds like you've researched that aspect of it pretty well.
Well, I love to do research, and so and I like to write books about things I'm interested in knowing about. So I was very interested in Isabella Stewart Gardner herself, in the heist, in the Boston art scene, and also in art forgery, which is just fascinating.
Well, yeah, it has many twists and turns, and even just the mechanics of it, which I think if people are interested in knowing, maybe not how to forge one themselves, but some of this could give you a pretty good background in how literally, you know, you have to work with these parts and maybe come out with something that no one could tell the difference.
Well, people have told me that if you have some artistic talent, they think that you could forge a painting after reading The Art Forger.
Well, was that something that you actually then went to? Tell me about that process of learning about it.
Well, I interviewed a lot of painters so that I understood how paintings were made. And then most of the information I got on forgery, I got out of a book called The Art Forger's Handbook. And literally, it on one page, it talked about how you copy a painting if you want to hang it on your living room wall. And on the other page, it talked about what you needed to do if you wanted to create an actual forgery that would fool the experts. So that's what I used.
Because it isn't illegal to make a copy of a painting.
Nope, not at all. It's only illegal to sell it as the work of the original artist when it isn't.
I learned a term, OTC, right?
Over the couch. That is a derogatory term that artists use to portray a piece of artwork that people will buy just because it looks good over their couch.
Yeah, we used to say sofa-size paintings.
Yeah,
was another way of that. But I was like, OTC. And then I get it. And it's sort of a little bit of the battle that's going on in your novel here with a protagonist who's got her own backstory but is actually involved in this sort of reproduction world, which apparently is a pretty big business in itself.
Yeah, well, she works for a company called Reproductions.com, and they pay her to copy paintings made by masters, and then they sell them as copies online. And it is a real business. She hates doing it, but she's been forced to do this because she's struggling and because she is a pariah in the art world, and no one is interested in her work. So this is the only way she can make money, and she does this during the day, and at night she works on her own paintings, which nobody wants.
I think that central character has enough different things going on to be part of what hooks people so well here. It's not just a one-dimensional character. It feels like you've really invested quite a bit in what she's had to go through and what she's going to, before the end of it all, have experienced, which Faustian comes to mind.
Yes, that's true. Well, when I was writing this book, I had written three books that hadn't gotten published, and I was struggling, and I wasn't being appreciated. I was working really hard. And so when the book opens, Claire is struggling, and she isn't being appreciated, and she's working really hard. So there are some parts of her character that are quite familiar to me.
Yeah, that actually that's really intriguing because it feels very lived in, that part of it, and in a world that you didn't live in, because at least to some extent I know your background. Did I see this systems analyst, sociology professor? You worked at a software. Hold on here.
If you live enough years, you know, you get to have a lot of careers.
And those in one way or another have all paled because you'd made a decision, I think, at some point that writing novels was really the winner.
That was what I always wanted to do, but I realized that I couldn't be a novelist and actually support myself. So I became a sociologist instead, because that's such a great way to support yourself. But it's what I always wanted to do, and I've written six novels before this, none of which went anywhere. They were published but didn't go anywhere. Then I wrote the three that didn't, and now suddenly I've written a novel that people are actually noticing. And 25 years in the trenches, and I'm an overnight success.
But you're B.A. Shapiro on the front.
B.A. on this book, Barbara on all the other ones.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Any particular reasoning here?
Well, the way it works is that bookstores, when a publisher is putting out books, they send out a catalog or whatever, and the bookstores look at it and they decide which books to order before they're published. And the decision is based primarily on the sales of the author's previous books. Barbara's books didn't sell that well, so it seemed like a slight name change. I also changed genres. I'd been writing psychological suspense, and this is more literary. So we decided it might be a good time for a different personality.
Well, you're going to bring that personality tonight to Unity Temple on the Plaza. You're going to be talking about The Art Forger as part of the series with Rainy Day Books, and that'll be a fun opportunity for you to share some of this.
Yes.
And people can call 913-384-3126. That's Rainy Day Books for ticket information. You're talking at 7. Like you say, you write psychological novels for a while. No one pays attention. Suddenly, The Art Forger makes an impact. And is it hard to understand why that change in people's reaction?
It's impossible to know why. I am just living the dream, and I could say this book is better than my previous books, but I'm not sure that. I do know for sure that my publisher is far better than any of my other publishers who were big publishers. This is a small publisher, Algonquin Press, mm-hmm. and they are just fabulous, and they got behind the book, and I've been on tour for almost a year now, going all over the country. They're behind it. They are behind me. And it makes all the difference.
Well, I was wondering if the art topic might in some ways be just, you know, the zeitgeist is right for that or something. Because, you know, Tom Wolfe's new book, Back to Blood, has some art forgery in it. I think Steve Martin recently wrote.
Yes, he did.
Maybe there's something about that. You know, that part of our world that people are really curious about, or it lends itself to this?
Well, people, when I talk to people, a lot of them say, I love art and I love books about art. So I think that it's another way, a book about art is another way to get inside art, probably differently than you would get inside art by visiting a museum. So I think that that's true. There seems to be a lot of interest in it.
And the high stakes of the game.
Yeah, very high, very high. And also the heist itself, the Gardner heist, happened in 1990, as you said. And it is the largest art heist in history, solved or unsolved. And a lot of people are really taken with it because it doesn't make a lot of sense how it was pulled off. It was fairly sloppy crime, and they've gotten away with it. They've investigated all kinds of possibilities. The Catholic Church was a suspect, the Irish Republican Army, the Mafia, of course, mm-hmm. and nothing, not a single piece has been found.
Were you wildly aware of it back at the time?
Yeah, I was living in Boston then, and I had always loved Isabella Stewart Gardner, so I had spent quite a bit of time at the museum, and one of the paintings that was stolen, the concert by Vermeer, was one of my all-time favorite paintings, And I used to go to the museum just to look at it. And it broke my heart when the crime happened. And it has been, you know, a very, very big deal in Boston for 23 years. And I finally figured out a way to write about it.
Well, it must have felt like a gash almost. You know, you look at these literally frames that no longer had the masterpiece in them.
Right. In her will, Isabella Stewart Gardner decreed that nothing in the museum could be changed, nothing could be added, nothing could be subtracted. And so when the paintings were stolen, they decided to keep the empty frames on the walls as, you know, waiting for the return.
And still waiting.
And still waiting.
Do you think your book might spur some well, I mean, seriously, it gets people talking?
Who knows? Anything that might help find those paintings would be such a wonderful thing. It is a horrible, horrible gash in the heart of the city, in the heart of any art lover. And I only hope the FBI has a new public awareness campaign that they're doing to try to bring attention to the crime and to bring attention to the paintings. If you go to FBI.gov/Gardner, they have all of the paintings there. And they're hoping that people will look at them and then go, oh, I just saw that at Uncle Joe's last week. But stranger things have happened, so maybe it'll help.
Well, speaking of strange things, art theft in the news here just the other day. Romania?
It's heartbreaking. I can't even stand thinking about it. These paintings were stolen from the Rotterdam Museum in October, actually just when this book came out. And they... The news is that they now believe that one of the thieves' mothers, in an effort to keep him from being arrested, burned all of the paintings, Picasso's.
See, these were big ticket items.
Real, real. She burned them. She burned them. I just turns my stomach. Oh, and she thought this was going to save him.
Yeah, seems
she doesn't watch CSI.
Seems strategically awry there, doesn't it? If you'd like to get in the conversation, we've got Barbara Shapiro here in the studios for about 10 more minutes. We'd love to hear from you on Up to Date at 816-235-2888. And you can see what you can add to maybe the search for those paintings, or we'll talk about some of these other factors about why art is so intriguing to read about. I think it's sensual sometimes when you're describing some of the actual process, and maybe that's just me.
Well, I think it's also a mysterious process. I mean, it is mysterious to me, the idea that you can conjure up these images that then evoke emotions and pleasure. And it's one thing to be able to write, to write a story. But to be able to do it without words, I think, is just fascinating. And I love art, but I have no artistic talent. And I think that I wrote a book with a protagonist who is an artist so that I could pretend to be her.
You know, that's pretty handy, isn't it,
that we
get to live out these things? It's sensual in the description sometimes of the art-making process. And there's a little romance going on in here as well. So did you write yourself in a really handsome leading man as well?
Well, why not? Totally in the image of my husband, right?
I was
obviously,
guessing.
Yes,
yeah, I was guessing that was where you were drawing
like
your inspiration from.
That was it.
But that, I'm assuming, as this makes the good summer read, that apparently it's turning out to be some of those, the combination of elements just hit those right notes.
Well, I had decided before I wrote this book that I wasn't going to try and put it in a genre. And the book did get rejected all over the place because it didn't fit into a genre. And now it's turning out that this combination of all these things that they said, if you make it more of a thriller, you make it more historical, you make it more chick lit, that there is something that because the book contains all of these things, I think people appreciate.
Yeah, that merging of those elements seems pretty comfortable for you. They don't seem forced, but I can imagine at some point you were thinking, oh, now how do I...
Multicolored file cards.
Really?
Yeah. Each plot gets a different color. And then I move them around on the dining room table and try to make it into a story.
Well, I was reading on your website a little bit about plots and how, you know, that's I guess we all being what I heard someone refer to as creatures of narrative not too long ago. Nice. We crave good plots, don't we?
Well, I actually think that our brains are wired to receive stories and to desire stories the same way they're wired for language. And there is a certain satisfaction in a traditional story well told that human beings get a lot of pleasure out of.
I'm with you on that. It just seems like there's a need for that almost. And when the right one comes along, we leap into that pond. So at this point, you must feel like, you know, your belief in that is being borne out in a nice way.
Oh, in a wonderful way. I can't believe I'm living my own life.
Well, what kind of responses have you gotten from people? Things where they really latched on to something that maybe you didn't even expect them to?
I'm just so touched and overwhelmed by how many people really love the book. I said this to somebody at Algonquin, and he said to me, which I thought was really interesting, he said, "Why are you surprised that people are interested in the same things that you're interested in?" And I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. People do seem to really love the art part. They love the art forgery part. They like the art theft part, the romance. It's just amazing to me to get this response after all of these years of getting no response. I mean, I go places and there are, you know, hundreds of people. Whereas with all my previous books, I had to bring my friends. I would recruit like 6 friends to go to each different event, so there would be people there. And I'm like, wow, I was in Wichita last night and didn't know anybody.
It's a good feeling, I'm sure.
It's a great feeling.
And you must be thinking, in situations like these, movie talk?
Yeah, well, my Hollywood agent, we just turned down our first movie offer because it was for a TV movie, and we're hoping for a regular movie. But you know what? For me, I have my book. The thing about a movie is that it sells more books, so that would be great. But if it doesn't get made into a movie, that's fine with me. Also, my son just wrote the first draft of the screenplay for it, so maybe he'll make it. He's a filmmaker.
Nice. Well, I often, when I'm reading, try to picture who might be playing those parts. I'm thinking Jessica Chastain would make a good Claire.
Yeah, she would be good. Claire Danes is actually who I see because she's so good at creating these complicated characters. My husband goes for Scarlett Johansson. Yeah, like any guy would.
I think they could all work. Right. Actually, Claire Danes, you know, now that you mention it, seems like a good person to carry some of that. Without going into too much, she's got some interesting baggage that kind of drives more of that. Are people telling the truth? Which is, I think, the hard part in some of these things to write into it, so that I don't just as a reader lose interest. Because if nobody's telling any truth, why do I care at all?
And also, not only are you wondering, I hope, in this book, who's telling the truth, but who's telling the truth to themselves? And this whole issue of rationalization. Every major character in the book has to cross a line to get what they want. And they each one of them decide, it is worth it for me to do this wrong thing in order to get what I want at the end. And, you know, I hope that readers think about this and wonder what they too would do to get what they want. And what do we do every day, the little things that we do to get what we want?
Well, and you even bent a little truth with Isabella Stewart Gardner's letters, I believe.
I did.
So you got to play a part, too.
Yes, it's a novel, so I get to make stuff up. That's the best part.
Yeah, and did you do a lot of research on her?
Oh, yeah. Well, I am fascinated with her. I don't know how much the listeners know about her, but she lived in the late 19th century, and she was a feminist before the word was even coined. eccentric, wild, and wonderful. She became the first great American art collector, man or woman, and lived this incredibly rich life surrounded by all of the painters and writers of the day, and something that women didn't do then. And so I read everything about her that I could get my hands on, including some letters, even though on her deathbed she burned all of her letters and told all of her friends to do the same.
I was amazed by that little part of it, that
yeah.
she expected her correspondents to also.
And most of them did, because when Bell talks, you listen. And fortunately, Bernard Berenson did not. And there's this fabulous book of their letters. And that was where I got the idea to write the fictional letters to tell her story.
Well, you'll be talking about all this again tonight with folks who come to see you at Unity Temple at 7 on the plaza there, Unity Temple. Barbara Shapiro is the author of this multifaceted mix of truth and fiction called The Art Forger. If you'd like ticket information on her appearance tonight, you should contact Rainy Day Books at 913-384-3126. Barbara, thanks for being here, and good luck tonight.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You can find more information on all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook, and this program in particular on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. The show is produced by Stephen Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, Caitlin Brennan, and Sangeeta Shastri. I'm Randy Mason, in for Steve Kraske this week, and you are up to date.